Jackson. Good morning, the great Midwest cities, towns, villages throughout our listening area. This is Jim Santel. I am once again delighted to be with you on this bright and sunny morning in downtown Waukesha. We're coming to you directly from the studios of WAUK Radio. That's the Shaw in Waukesha. It's 540 AM, 101 FM. Again, Jim Santel, morning cannolis. This is our weekend review of the important stories in law, in government, and yes, also the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you so much for joining me. We have a full package of information pieces to chat about this morning, to review from this past week and beyond. Today is also a special presentation, a special program here on Morning Cannolis, because we're going to be spending a lot of our time in the second portion of this first hour, and then going into the second hour talking about a major significant anniversary in the civil rights, the human rights history of our nation and our world, and that is the violence, the shooting at the Sikh temple, the Gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, 10 years ago yesterday. And today and tomorrow, in addition to this past week, items of commemoration, times of gathering for the community there in Oak Creek. We'll tell you more about those at the end of our second hour, ways in which you can participate today and tomorrow in recognizing, in acknowledging the problems of our nation still when it comes to violence and the challenges faced by religious communities nationwide, but also recommitting to a time of greater peace and understanding among all peoples. So lots of things going on in Oak Creek. I'm going to go back and tell you exactly what happened there 10 years ago yesterday, revisiting some of the specific stories of that time. But today is a Saturday, August 6th. It is the 218th year of the calendar, 147 days left to go. Normally at this time, I review four or five or six significant events in the history of our world, our nation, our state. This morning, just two of those. It was on August 6th of 1945, 77 years ago today, that we dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima. More power than 120,000 tons of TNT, killed anywhere from 70 to 140,000 people. Estimates vary dramatically, as you can well imagine. Know that from history as well. The bomb itself, called the Little Boy, 130 pounds of uranium-235, the first time in human history that a nuclear weapon used on any civilian population by the United States of America. Certainly devastating to Japan, bringing undeniably a sooner conclusion to World War II. Nonetheless, an important milestone in the history of humankind on this planet. We know as well, 3 days later, August 9th of 1945, a second bomb dropped on Nagasaki, and again, bringing the Second World War perhaps to a sooner conclusion, but nonetheless, a significant event because of that huge, huge event in Japan on these days in 1945, 77 years ago. Jumping ahead quite a bit, 57 years ago, it was on August 6th of 1965 that President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We have talked a lot about the Voting Rights Act on this very program. Other times when I have had the great privilege and honor of coming into your homes and your businesses to talk about the very significant decisions of the United States Supreme Court in recent years affecting the Voting Rights Act. It was on August 6, 1965, that Lyndon Johnson gathered a number of civil rights leaders, gathered the community together at the White House to sign the Voting Rights Act of 1965, establishing, among other things, these nationwide protections for voting rights, especially those areas, that those jurisdictions that are imposing restrictions principally on people of color, principally our black populations that were being denied, abridged the right of to vote under our Constitution on account of race or color, is the way that the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act sets forth that prohibition. Other prohibitions prohibiting literacy tests and other devices that were historically used to prevent people of color from voting in this country. We know as well that Sections 4 and 5 also established this so-called coverage formula and a pre-clearance procedure that required But those jurisdictions that had historically at that time and in the years that followed, had developed a tradition, a practice of engaging in discriminatory practices when it comes to prohibiting people of color from voting. In those instances, before changes could be made in the voting rights laws of those jurisdictions, you had to get authorization from where? The United States Department of Justice, the Attorney General, and the Civil Rights Division looking at all of those. That was called the pre-clearance procedure, the enforcement under the coverage formula of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and until a case called Shelby County during a recent administration, the full force and effect of the Voting Rights Act to ensure the franchise was extended to all people in this nation was in full force. And then in Shelby County, the United States Supreme Court, in a case authored by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, found that Sections 4 and 5 were unconstitutional because they no longer represented, in Justice Roberts' view and the view of the majority of the Supreme Court, the status of civil rights and the prohibitions on people of color to vote in America, felt they had to be updated, and so found that the interaction of Sections 4 and 5 was unconstitutional and basically removed those from the strong capacity of the law to ensure that voting rights are permitted and enforced for all people. And then just last year in August of 2021, another major decision, a case called Brnovich, named after the Attorney General of the state of Arizona, a fellow who is still in the news these days. Case in which the Supreme Court dealt yet another blow to the Voting Rights Act of 1965 by supporting under Section 2 the authorization of the Arizona legislature to impose some regulations, some restrictions, frankly, on the manner and means of voting in Arizona that many people feel strongly inhibited the capacity of the Department of Justice to go forward. To this day, Sections 2, Sections 4 and 5 are not routinely accessible to the United States Department of Justice as it was envisioned 57 years ago today. Nonetheless, there are remedies for that pending in the Congress. We have talked about those before, especially under the name of John Lewis. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act passed by the United States House of Representatives, still waiting for passage by the Senate to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to where it was 57 years ago today. This landmark piece of legislation passed And now, not nearly as strong and impactful as it was at that time. Both very significant events in the history of our nation, August 6, 1945, and August 6, 1965, on this day. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. This is Morning Cannolis. We're also going to be taking your phone calls throughout this morning, our first hour, our second hour in particular. When again, our syllabus includes a lot of focus on the history of this day and years that have followed since that time in the wake of the Sikh temple shooting, the Sikh Gurdwara shooting that happened on August 5th, 10 years ago yesterday. We're going to chat about what exactly happened that day as a way of understanding our history, and then going to spend a lot of time talking about what has happened since that time, things that have been undertaken, yes, by the Sikh community nationwide, locally, but also by many, many people to address what happened there. As we know well, gun violence continues to be a major issue in our nation, and we also know that places of worship under the First Amendment continue to be places that are most regrettably, most unfortunately, tragically, horrifically targeted by some people who feel that is an appropriate way of pursuing their own very narrow, very hate-inspired agendas. And so we're going to think about all of that today and spend some time discussing about that. But before we get to any of that, in our first minutes and perhaps even our first segment and beyond this morning, I'm going to be chatting about four major stories, most of which were somewhat in the news, but principally undercovered from my perspective this past week, that also impact who we are in our nation and where we have been. I began by talking today and inviting your conversation, inviting your attention to our second major movement this morning, chatting about the Sikh temple shooting. Guns, as you know, animate lots of our lives in America, again, with great tragic consequences. That includes the consequences of January 6th. We know from just this past week that a fellow named Guy Wesley Reffitt, R-E-F-F-I-T-T, he was convicted in March of this year after going to a trial, which is his right. A jury trial, 5 counts on a case that was in many ways a test case for the Department of Justice. He was charged with a number of different counts, including matters related to the riot, the insurrection on January 6th, 2 counts of civil disorder. He also carried a .40 caliber pistol during that riot, also a part of the presentation during the trial. A jury finds him guilty of all of those charges. Mr. Reffitt did not go inside the Capitol on that day, but in many ways, his conviction, the sentence imposed this past week by Judge Daphne Friedrich, she looked at all the circumstances and imposed a 7-year and 3-month sentence upon him, the highest sentence, the most extensive sentence to date imposed upon any defendant in the January 6th prosecutions, and specifically said, you know, the fact that you didn't go into the Capitol does not make this less important. She basically went in the opposite direction and said, because plainly you brought a gun to that location. And also another significant portion of this, he was at the tip of the spear, as many people say, encouraging people to break in, to do the violence, to engage in the activity that led to the deaths of people, huge numbers of injuries to our law enforcement authorities and others. And significantly, Guy Reffitt, at the time of his return to his home, told his children, his son and his daughter, not to tell anyone. He threatened them and said that if any of them went to law enforcement, he would impose upon them some responses to that. He said, traitors get shot. And that also a part of the prosecution. Guy Reffitt, this past week, sentenced to more than 7 years in prison. And nonetheless, he's going to be appealing that. A major, major case in the wake of the January 6th prosecution. Guy Reffitt says this, I did want to make an apology. In 2020, he said, I was a little crazy. Everything went a little stupid. Well, regrettably, we've got an awful lot of people who did an awful lot of stupid things, violent things, things that undermine our history, things that undermine our traditions on January 6th of this year. I'm going to talk about other stories of this past week, also, regrettably, involving violence. Right after this break, we're here at WAUK Radio. This is the Shaw and Waukesha. This is the Morning Cannolis. Join us at 844-967-2789. Jim Santel. This is Morning Cannolis. We're talking this morning, as we always do, Saturday mornings from 9 to 11, about law, government, and justice in America. Right before the break, I was reviewing with you some of the major and perhaps underreported stories of this past week, as we always do, chatting about Guy Reffitt right before the break and the conviction and sentence imposed upon him, a man who brought a gun to the Capitol on January 6th, going to be spending time in federal prison as a result of that, plainly expressing some regret to the federal district court judge before whom he appeared. Nonetheless, a lesson, a deterrence, not only for Mr. Reffitt to ensure that he doesn't do this anymore, but also a message I would offer to deterrence generally, that people who engage in this kind of conduct, you will in fact be investigated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, prosecuted by the United States Department of Justice. And we know that there are about 800 other people who fall into that same category. And we also know, reaffirmed this past week, that with respect to other people who were in charge of organizing things on January 6th, people like the Three Percenters, of which Mr. Reffitt was probably a member, Proud Boys, others out there, they're also being charged with seditious conspiracy to overthrow the government. And we know once again with absolute clarity that the U.S. Department of Justice is also has convened a grand jury that's looking at the top levels of direction, supervision from the White House, other places. Undeniably, we know that now because people are getting subpoenas to appear before a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C., looking at this statements made by the Deputy Attorney General about the focus of this false electors matter that came out of Wisconsin and other states. Other people, obviously, the results of investigation, being contacted by the Federal Department of Justice and the FBI to talk about this, requests for transcripts from the January 6th committee. Undeniably, the United States Department of Justice, in addition to prosecuting those people like Mr. Reffitt, who were on the ground on January 6th, not only moving up the chain, but now at the top of that chain. And we will look forward to hearing more from Merrick Garland, our Attorney General, and others about the results of those grand jury presentations in the weeks and perhaps months ahead. Three other stories before we get on to our principal topic this morning, which is once again the 10-year anniversary of the Sikh Gurdwara shooting in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. There are other stories that also are significant in the category of justice and law enforcement in America. This one, also a matter of charges. This one coming out of the federal district court in the U.S. Attorney's Office, the U.S. Department of Justice in Louisville, Kentucky. Listeners will remember well that in a nighttime raid in March of 2020, more than 2 years ago, officers entered into the home of Breonna Taylor and her boyfriend that night. An officer engaged initially, the boyfriend responded, and the melee that followed in Ms. Taylor, this 26-year-old emergency room technician, being killed in the violence that happened as a result of what can only be regarded as a terribly mishandled and misconducted search and entry into that home. Well, it turns out, as many of us suspected, even from the public reporting on this at the time, that this was more than simply a mismanaged matter involving law enforcement on the execution of the warrant. This is much more than that. And this past week, the Attorney General announced charges on officers who were responsible for obtaining that search warrant in the first place. So let's step back and do a little bit of civics on this as well. In order to get a warrant under the Fourth Amendment, or right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, and that is construed to mean that before any federal officer, a state officer, can get entry into your home without your consent, a federal magistrate, a state court judge, someone in a judicial capacity has to take a look at the evidence presented and find that there is probable cause to believe that inside that home, somewhere in those premises, there is evidence of a crime. So this is not a matter where simply agents can go in because they've got some belief that there is evidence of a crime. A federal judge has got to take a look at it. A state judge, a state magistrate's got to review that information and specifically authorize that to happen. The charges that came out of this particular case this week announced, and again, we hasten to add that, as always, defendants in our state and federal systems are presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury or otherwise consent to enter a plea in this case. The charges say that two detectives and a police sergeant falsely claimed in the supporting affidavit before that judge to obtain that warrant that the former boyfriend, the colleague, the friend of Breonna Taylor, again, terribly killed in this incident, had been receiving packages at the apartment when, in fact, according to the indictment against these law enforcement officers, they had no such evidence, that there really wasn't evidence, and that they misrepresented this case to the judge who authorized that raid, premised apparently in large part upon that false information. One of the agents knew the claim was false, didn't object to it, and added what they described as misleading claims that the former boyfriend was using the address as Ms. Taylor's apartment to get these packages. And so
fundamental misrepresentations about the predicate to get into the house in the first place. Third officer also charged with an investigative unit, lack of supervision there, approving that affidavit, knowing that it contained this false information. And so a very, very significant indictment this past week. It does not bring Breonna Taylor back to life, as we know well. Her death remains a tragedy in this nation, but it underscores as well the importance of law enforcement to do its job, not just competently. We know beyond that, that the very execution of this improperly issued, improperly predicated warrant was done in a terribly, terribly violent and inappropriate manner. Nonetheless, we have charges this past week that because of this, Ms. Taylor and others were deprived of their rights under the Constitution of the United States of America to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. In this case, it led to Ms. Taylor's death. Very significant item in the history of our nation this past week. And then we also know as we go into break that coming out of another violent event, that is the violence at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. 19 first graders, 6 educators shot there. This past week, some important information coming from a civil jury in Texas this past week involving misstatements, lies, misrepresentations, call them all of that, you'd be accurate in doing so, by Alex Jones, who said, among other things, that that violent activity, those deaths never happened. None of this is made up. As a result of what the jury did there, Mr. Jones, as we'll talk about beyond the break, facing not only compensatory damages, but also now punitive damages. I want to chat more about what that means. We're going to talk about the implications of that for Mr. Jones and the things he's got to face down the road yet as we continue to have our discussion this morning and go into our next break here on Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. We invite you, as always, to call in at 844-967-2789. Let's continue this morning our discussion of some of the major news stories from this past week. Right before the break, we were reviewing this story coming out of Texas and a jury there that had imposed now punitive damages on Alex Jones, who was this fellow who for many years through his group called Free Speech Systems had parlayed this misinformation, peddled this misinformation about the Sandy Hook shooting, and was previously found liable for defaming the victim's families there, spreading these bogus theories that the shooting had been part of a government plot to confiscate America's firearms, and the victim's families had been complicit in that scheme, a complete fabrication, a lie, as we all know, for a long period of time. Previously, once again, he was found liable for that. The recent proceedings before the jury in the trial court there would determine how much money he would have to pay to the families, and in particular, parents named Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis, the parents of young Jesse Lewis, who was 6 years old at the time that he and some 18 other first graders, along with their 6 teachers, were killed at Sandy Hook. And so earlier in the week, the jury found that there would be an award of $4 million in compensatory damages. What are compensatory damages? That means the things that are provided to, are supplied to a plaintiff in this particular case to ensure that they are at least trying to make them whole. Great amount of information presented during this portion of the trial to indicate, to prove to the jury that these parents and others had suffered greatly, pursued by followers of InfoWars and Alex Jones, had to relocate many, many times, had to be secret and clandestine about where they're moving because of the threats against them, profoundly changed their lives. And as a result of that, that as a result of that, the jury found that to compensate them, to try to make them somewhat more whole, always incomplete, the jury awarded $4 million. And then just yesterday came back and awarded a whopping $45.2 million in punitive damages over and above that $4 million amount. What are punitive damages about? It's what the word says. It's purely punitive. It is punishing you for doing the behavior. Compensatory damages, once again, restoring you, trying to give you some sense of money to make you whole, to restore what was taken from you as a result of the misconduct. And again, in this case, these wild, unsupported, and harming reports about what did and did not happen at Sandy Hook. Punitive damages, simply saying we are punishing you for doing what you have done. And so a huge result coming out of that Texas jury. Undeniably, a number of things going to be undertaken by Alex Jones' attorneys, including, once again, a threat to go into bankruptcy court. We know that there is yet another lawsuit in Connecticut going ahead next month in Connecticut. Again, the same kind of thing, alleging that Mr. Jones, as a result of his misinformation, his lies, his peddling these false statements about Sandy Hook, caused damage. But this past week, again, nearly $50 million imposed upon him in compensatory and punitive damages, again, for his wild misconduct in misrepresenting to America, causing great harm, not only to the families, but also to our nation, in encouraging people to believe things that are not true, a common theme that we have seen over and over again. And finally, our other big news story this past week, which I suspect many, if not all of you, have followed. And a secondary story in the same vein, probably less covered, and that is abortion rights. We know from the Dobbs case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, from late June 24th of this year, that the United States Supreme Court, in an opinion written for the majority by Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, the Supreme Court overruled Roe versus Wade, another case called Casey, finding that there was a constitutional right to abortion, overruled that finding that was in place for nearly 50 years, and instead found no such predicate in the Constitution, sending this back basically to the states to act and to pursue their own remedies as they choose to address the issues in ways that legislatures and the public should address this issue. Again, stripping away this longstanding privacy right under the Constitution for the entire nation, nonetheless, coming back to the states. And so this past week in both Kansas and Idaho, some important developments. You know the Kansas story. This past week, Kansas voters overwhelmingly, resoundingly decided against removing the right to abortion from the state constitution there. You may recall that in previous times, the state constitution, and to this day, had basically affirmed the right to an abortion in the state of Kansas. Came out of some lawsuits in 2019, a ruling by the Kansas Supreme Court that had struck down some abortion restrictions under the state constitution. So it has been legal and authorized in Kansas. This past week, this goes to a referendum there, overwhelmingly, resoundingly rejected a move to amend the constitution to prohibit abortions in Kentucky and in Kansas, rather. And as a result of that, abortion remains legal in Kansas significantly up to 22 weeks of pregnancy, which is generally viewed these days, 22, 23 weeks, as a time of viability. That is a result in Kansas that is, in fact, consistent with Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood. And the other story that comes out of this past week, comes out of and devolves from work in Idaho. That is the United States Department of Justice, once again, looking at ways to remedy problems in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision. In this particular case, Merrick Garland announcing that the Department of Justice, United States of America, suing Idaho, the state of Idaho, over a very strict abortion law that was set to take effect this month that would inhibit emergency room doctors from performing abortions that are necessary to stabilize, to keep in place the health of women facing medical emergencies. You might think, well, gee, how is that possible in the wake of the rescission of Roe versus Wade? And the answer is that there is a law called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. The Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, invoked by the Attorney General, invoked by the U.S. Attorney's Office there in Idaho, that attacks this attempt by the folks in Idaho to restrict access, restrict doctors from emergency room access to provide medical care to their patients. The lawsuit argues that this federal law is violated by that. And Garland says, in particular, there have been widespread reports of delays and denials of treatment to pregnant women experiencing emergencies. This is an important issue because it underscores the importance, the significance, the movement of the Department of Justice to address abortion rights, address the capacity of people to pursue privacy rights in this country through other means. Now that it's back in the states, to find other statutory and other mechanisms for ensuring what was in fact the law in this nation for nearly 50 years. And again, a significant story, a significant event coming out of Idaho. We'll see what happens with that lawsuit. It's a civil lawsuit. It is not a criminal action, unlike the Breonna Jones matter, which Breonna Taylor matter, which we talked about earlier. It is, again, a very important case in the wake of and the midst of the continuing efforts by states in all directions to address our status in the wake of Dobbs and the restriction, the limitations, the rescission of the privacy right under the Constitution of the United States of America. That, a brief summary of some of the significant goings-on in justice in America this past week. And now we're going to turn back to a story, a series of events, circumstances that are going on even as we speak in Oak Creek. Harkening back to the horrific events of August 5th of 2012. August 5th of 2012. We began last week by chatting with you about the Sikh faith, Sikhism, this 500-year-old religion, the fifth largest faith on the face of the planet, provided you with some information about the basic understandings, including nonviolence and meditation and the commitment to the wellness of the entire human race, self-discipline, the concepts of work and industry, sharing, and most importantly, this thing called Sewa, S-E-W-A, the concept of service to all people, significant for all Sikhs, including those in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, other states of the Union, and across the entire globe. We talked about those last week. Today, in our remaining moments of this hour and into the next segments of our second hour, we're going to be reviewing exactly what happened on August 5th of 2012, talking about the specifics of that day, the memories of that day. We're going to talk as well about ways in which you, this weekend, can be a part of the memories of that time, of the acknowledgement of the horror of those days, but also movements forward as we think about Oak Creek and the 7 people killed, many other injured at that time. Continue to join us this week, this day, as we chat about that here on Morning Cannolis. Join us at 844-967-2789. For the final minutes of this first hour of Morning Cannolis, a review of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you again for joining me this hour as we reviewed some of the major stories in America and began the discussion that will continue into our second hour this morning. I invite you to stay with us wherever you are, because we're going to chat a lot about what exactly happened on August 5th of 2012. We're not going to get into graphic stories or
accounts of that day. But it's important to remember what occurred in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. It has so unfortunately been repeated so many times in America, not just at places of worship, but in other locations where we live and breathe and go about our lives. And so we're going to talk about that, especially in our second hour this morning here on Morning Cannolis. In our last moments of this particular hour, I wanted to tell you about ways in which you yourself can become involved in events in Oak Creek, even as we speak. We do all of this. We do all of this in memory of and recollection of the terrific, horrific sacrifices made by individuals, both people injured, many, many people injured physically, emotionally, spiritually, intellectually. They continue to this day to suffer from those injuries. And then we know as well that the gunman on August 5th of 2012 made martyrs, killed seven people, all of whom were parishioners, were congregation members, were members of that congregation there at the Oak Creek Sikh Temple. And their names, Satwan Kaleka. He was 62. He was the president of the Gurdwara. He was the founder of the Gurdwara. He was the one who was, in major ways, the leader of that organization. We'll tell you more about his specific heroism on the morning of August 5th of 2012. Paramjeet Kaur was 41 years old, young mother, devoted congregation member, participating in all the activities and events of the Sikh Gurdwara, including that morning, August 5th of 2012. Baba Punjab Singh, 73, he was a priest called a Granthi of the Gurdwara. Baba Punjab was seriously injured on that morning. He lived for two more years until March of 2020, when finally, as a result of the wounds he suffered on August 5th, he died. And so he is among those who undeniably killed as a result of this horrific shooting, this hate crime event. During the course of his life, even after the shooting, continued to communicate, had what was called Chardi Kala, this unrelenting optimism about the future. His name and his family, plainly a part of history now because of their being victims of this horrific event. Prakash Singh, 39 years old, just 39 years old, another priest, another Granthi at the Gurdwara, likewise providing service for many years there to the congregation members. His family, heartbroken, crestfallen as a result of his death as well. Ranjit Singh, 49 years old. He was a Raji, R-A-A-G-E-E of the Gurdwara, a hymn vocalist, providing huge and glorious and wonderful music at the Gurdwara for many years as well. Likewise, his life taken on August 5th. Another priest, another Granthi, Sita Singh, 41, likewise martyred on August 5th of 2012. Also a beloved, wonderful member of the congregation lost to the violence that day. And Suvig Singh, 84, likewise a devoted congregation member of the Sikh faith in that location, someone whose family, again, horrifically, terribly missing him to this day. Those seven people, Satwan, Paramjeet, Baba Punjab, Prakash, Ranjit, Sita, and Suvig, all today and throughout this weekend and throughout the years that have passed since August 5th, memorialized and remembered as critically wonderful people, a part of this congregation, critically important workers who supported the initiatives both at the temple and beyond in the community. We're going to talk more about that in our second hour. We remember them this day. We remember the people injured as well. Regard them as heroes for reasons that you will learn if you don't already know this about the things that they did and the sacrifices they made that day in many ways to ensure that the disaster, the crisis, the tragedy there was not even greater than it already was. And so those are the folks who sacrificed their lives on that day. During the course of this past week, the leaders of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, joining with government, including the U.S. Department of Justice and the Community Relations Service, a group that was tremendously important at the time of the shooting, gathering together members of the community as well, other institutions of government, private sector, victim support specialists, all sorts of people gathering this past week to commemorate, to remember the event,
and to commission further activities going forward. So let me tell you a little bit about what happened in the past couple of days. And then as we go into our final moments here, the things you can do today and tomorrow, also to be a part of the events going on in Oak Creek. This past Thursday at the City Hall, a wonderful engagement about what hate crimes mean today in America, how those are prosecuted here in Wisconsin, in federal system, in state courts. I was honored at that time to moderate a panel that talked about the ways in which our leadership, our faith leadership, the Muslim faith, the Sikh faith, the Christian faith, Hindu faith, Buddhist faith, all faiths can in fact ensure that their places of worship are safe and secure. Delighted and truly honored to be a part of that program that also focused upon messaging to our larger community, an emotional but supremely human time of assembly at the City Hall. That on Thursday, much of that still available by way of video for your review and access down the road. And then beginning last night at 6 o'clock to about 9 o'clock, even 10 o'clock, this amazing vigil. You probably saw, if you have not already done so, you can, again, pull up videos of this Remembrance Vigil of August 5th of 2012, including candlelight presentations, impacts by members of the families of those seven people, the children, the grandchildren, who were obviously 10 years younger, some of them barely remembering the event, now bemoaning the fact that they do not have fathers and a mother and grandfathers to include them in their families, talking last night out of their hearts, out of their minds, about the importance of this event, the importance of remembering their lost ones, but also commissioning all of us to do much better in the future to ensure safety and security. Again, I was so very honored to chat about the implications of that day of August 5th, and to talk in particular about the things that happened, the good things, the only positive things that came of this tragedy. We're going to talk more about those in our second hour as well, including some amazing educational things now going on in the state of Wisconsin about six, some amazing things happening at the Oak Creek Library, the largest public collection, non-private collection of Sikh studies materials. Now that exists, ways in which law enforcement records and memorializes evidence of hate crimes in America, all those changes happening as a result of this horrific event on August 5th of 2012. And so what can you do? How can you participate even today in these events of this past decade or so, beginning at 11 o'clock. Yes, that's right. Just as we're concluding on the air today, a major Chardikala community event happening on the grounds of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin. Chardikala, once again, this Punjabi expression used by the Sikh faith to underscore internal optimism, great anticipation about the future, even in the wake of tragedy, of huge setbacks, which this plainly was and is, a sense of movement forward. A Chardikala community event, 11 to 3. You can show up whenever you would like. It is a part of a program going on the grounds outside and inside. So what's happening? Literally, beginning in about an hour from now. A Chardikala community event at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, outdoors, a number of different community civic organizations presenting information about anti-violence initiatives, about ways in which you can have a greater involvement in civil rights and human rights in our community and beyond. Tremendous resources available to you. It is free of charge. And then at the same time, 11 to 3, 4 hours of workshops and engagements, discussions of instruction, both formal and informal, about everything, once again, from civil rights to ways in which youth and middle-aged people and older people can become involved in their communities. There's going to be a session on turban tying, believe it or not, understanding what the significant symbols of the Sikh faith are all about, including the turban, which we talked about a bit last week in our program here. A great opportunity to learn more about the Sikh faith, to be there, to let people know that you support not only this particular congregation, but congregations of people throughout the United States of America and across our nation. That 11 o'clock to 3 p.m., there is a registration possibility, but you can also simply show up and be there at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin. And then tomorrow morning, at their regular services, a time of a tribute to the departed souls, additional speeches and presentations made well-wishers to the congregation, memorializing the seven people lost, the folks who were injured in the course of this horrific tragedy, all of that taking place. The Sikh Gurdwara, the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, Oak Creek, its location, 7512 South Howell Avenue, the main street right in downtown Oak Creek, easily accessible from throughout the state of Wisconsin, even from northern Illinois, other places, 7512 South Howell Avenue. There is parking there, availability there. You are most welcome. And on behalf of the congregation leadership there, I invite you to be a part of the events going on this afternoon and again tomorrow, Sunday, August 7th, at the Sikh Gurdwara. As we begin to finish up today, we invite you to come back for our second hour talking more about all this. This is Morning Cannolis at WAU.